me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Today we meet Ann Hand. She is a writer, global education expert, whose work bridges personal history and social change. Born in New York, she has divided her time between Massachusetts and Mexico City, exploring what it means to belong across borders. Her debut memoir, Austrian Again, traces her journey through Austria's citizenship process for descendants of Holocaust refugees and the unexpected rediscovery of her family's hidden past. With empathy and curiosity, Anne reflects on identity, memory, and the legacies we inherit. A graduate of Harvard University, she's devoted her career to advancing equity and opportunity through education and technology around the world. Today, we take a deeper, more intimate look at her book, Austrian Again, Reclaiming a Lost Legacy. This is a homecoming, a joyful tribute to the power of belonging. This book is a much-needed reminder for all of us who are immigrants, for those of us who seek to know the truth that sometimes changes our own theories, in that, truly, there is no place like home. And welcome to the show.
Hey, Jules. Hey, everybody listening at home. I'm really glad to be here. And just thank you so much for that big, you know, hug of a welcome.
Listen, we are so excited. And New York is in the house. Before we dive in, tell us a little bit about you and your world before writing this book. And who is Ann Hand?
That's a big question. I think before I wrote the book, you know, I was working a lot. I was kind of on the just, you know, what am I supposed to do? What's the right path? What are the things that I went to school for? And, you know, how can I make a difference in the world, you know, on this very particular pathway that I was kind of already on, you know, that treadmill when we start working and we don't always know how to, you know, make a turn or how to even get off if that's something we want to do and we're lucky to be able to do. And when I started writing the book, it was, you know, I didn't realize how much it was really going to change my perspective and the way that I move through the world. And I'd say that now, you know, the book's coming out, I think I'm much more confident in myself. I feel very grounded in who I am and where I come from. And, you know, work is work and it's always going to be work. But there are ways to kind of do things different and to really, I think, feel in your gut that, you know, you're going in the right direction, you're talking to the right people and you're doing the right things.
Before we got on set, I really touched base on this power move and your book. I don't want to give too much about it, but honestly, it was great storytelling because you allowed us to kind of see you from just being humble to then being reactive to then becoming this superhero. You stepped into something that usually some of us only dream about. We think about something, we want to take action, but it's not that easy to just jump in and really do something to make a change. And you did do that. Tell us a little bit, because what touched me the most was here you are just sifting through your regular day and something happens. You are reading the paper. And what was the first emotion you felt when you saw that headline in the Guardian that kind of set this whole journey for you in motion?
I think more than anything else, it was curiosity. So, you know, it was maybe 6 months into COVID, more or less. And I was just, yeah, like at my computer, like I was every day. And there was this headline saying that Austria would allow for the descendants of people who were persecuted before and during World War II. A lot of Jewish people, a lot of people whose ancestors, were socialists and other kinds of political activists. And people who just really pushed back against the regime, or they couldn't push back against the regime. They were persecuted from the beginning. And I knew that there was something in my family history where, it seemed like we would qualify for it. I knew that my great grandmother had had to flee in 1938 after the Nazis took over Austria. But it wasn't really something I'd ever thought of before. I never thought that having the opportunity to have this door open would ever happen. I knew of Austria as like this country way over there. My family had come to the US, they'd built their lives here, and everybody was very, very American. And I think we all felt very American. And I was just curious about kind of what this meant and what I could find. And I was able to find so much. And the thing that was really striking in a lot of ways, and I think that this happens to a lot of people, is that when, families have this kind of trauma, whether it's, and there's obviously like different levels of intensity and different things that people can handle. But, even just moving countries and immigrating under normal circumstances, that's really difficult. And then you add, all these other layers of what's going on in the world, that nobody had any control over, and they just felt very lucky to get out. So you add all that, and a lot of the time people don't want to talk about what happened. And so for me, it was this journey of, I thought it was just going to be scratching the surface, but I didn't have to scratch very hard to really sort of let the sand go. And then all of a sudden, there was all this information, all this stuff that was actually really easy to find. And it really changed the way I understood my own family and our past.
What I liked about your book a lot was that you were sharing emotion at each level. It made me feel that I was with you or just reading along your side to kind of understand some of the emotions you dealt with. And you used words that were very typical in our language, rabbit hole, and being able to unpack some of these things. Tell us a little bit about your grandfather. That's what drew me like the most about this, your connection to him and how you're trying to lift up his legacy.
I think that, so my grandfather was the immigrant. Like he came over to New York in the 20s, so a long time ago now. And he lived in New York his whole life, pretty much after that. And I think he considered himself a New Yorker very early on, and not even just because he was living there, but like his attitude and his hustle and kind of the way he moved through the world. Like he was totally a New Yorker. And he was just one of those people that, when he passed away, everybody was devastated. He was just, I don't think he ever considered himself anybody special, but he was that person that everybody really loved to be around, that kind of glued everybody together, because he was, funny and kind, and not funny like, oh, ha ha ha, whatever. Like he had an edge, he was one of those people who would really try to, make things interesting and make things a little bit more spicier or whatever. And he was an artist, but he was sort of in economic circumstances for most of his life where that didn't pay the bills, and he had to pay the bills. And that was also kind of at the forefront of who he was. So when he retired and he didn't have to, design furniture anymore, he didn't have to build cabinets. He started, creating art and, leaning into that part of who he was. So I think in a way this book, it was a way to also better understand kind of where he came from, and this really, magnificent, dynamic person, who I only knew who for a very short time, but the people who knew him for much longer, everybody really, really loved him. So I'm glad that, shines through, and that's another, piece of the work that, and just the writing and everything, is I wanted to take people on this journey with me. And the journey's not sequential. So the book starts out with my grandfather and kind of talking about him and the family stories, but then it goes backwards, and then it goes forwards, and then it kind of goes backwards a little bit again, and then it's kind of like, okay, but you know, what does this mean? And I feel like if you know, Jules, if you felt you were along for the ride and going on the journey, and the story, the different family stories about my grandfather were enough to pull you in, I mean, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that, you know, I was able to do that, and I'm so happy that I could.
Listen, you did him justice. And by the way, you know him until about the age of 11 and somewhat. You kind of allowed us to know him. I was with him even when he bought that one-way ticket and started this journey to kind of lead you along this path. But I think that you were able to really dig in and support not only his legacy, his life story, but you brought his struggles and you brought light to some of that humor earlier, that's how he challenged himself when things were going really tough. He didn't take shortcuts. He made things maybe harder than they should have been, but he did not want to get something that he did not earn. And that's what I respected about that kind of work ethic. Tell us a little bit about how was your understanding of your family as you're getting into this research, and maybe a little bit about yourself that kind of changed the process for you as you were writing becoming the Austrian citizenship part of it.
Yeah. So I guess for me, just because, you know, I grew up in the US and there was never any question about where we were from, and my grandfather, you know, he was, when I was growing up, he was the one person who had immigrated, and, you know, he never spoke German. German was his native language. He never taught it to my mom and my aunt. Everybody just grew up speaking English. And, you know, so this question of identity and kind of where we're from, it always felt very, very, very American, very much from New York. I mean, my grandparents were in Brooklyn and on Long Island, and, you know, we were upstate a little bit, but, you know, that's what happens, right? People move out of the city where there's jobs and where there's stuff to do. I mean, that's kind of what happens to a lot of people. So for me, you know, this sense of identity and kind of having New York as the center of culturally of like where I was from and what I was about, that was always very, very solid. And so, you know, as I grew up and we lived out of state and I started to travel for myself and for work and to go to college and, you know, all this stuff, right? And life happens. I think I always sort of kept New York really as kind of the core of who I was as a person, even if I wasn't in the city and even if I wasn't, you know, it was always the place that I could come back to and just feel comfortable, just like, you know, get out of the bus or train or whatever and get down the street and be like, oh yeah, it's still the city. And so, you know, that sort of sense of self, I think, was very, very strong in me. But when I started to do the research and I started to dig a little more and I started to learn more about, you know, my own family's immigration and past, and not just immigration to New York, but also like within Europe, there was a lot of movement, you know, back when, you know, my great grandparents were moving around in different, I mean, now it's like four different countries, but back then it was all part of the same country in Central Europe. And, you know, there's that like push and there's that hustle that they had even before they came to New York. And I think that came through for me really strongly as I started to do the research and I saw, you know, like where they were living, where they got married, where people were born, you know, and you start to trace the pathway and you see the towns get bigger and you say, okay, they're looking for something, you know, they want something better for themselves. They want something better for their kids. So understanding that and that like feeling, that drive, like it comes from something much bigger. And it made me feel really connected, I think, to different, you know, people who all have this dream and all, you know, we all want the same things, right? Like we all want to do good for ourselves. We want to do better for our kids and we want to leave the world a better place than we found it. Or I hope so, you know, I think a lot of people do want that. So, you know, to understand that this push comes from like a long way back, it made me want to connect with that more. And it made me want to connect with these stories and these people that like clearly, you know, had, you know, their own struggles and their own way of doing things. And, you know, in whatever circumstances we're in, you know, we try to do the best we can with what we have. So it was great to learn more about that, to understand more about that. And I think to also understand sort of in the bigger picture of all this stuff, yeah, because these are all normal people, right? We're all normal people here, just, you know, talking. I hope that they would be happy, you know, with, you know, fast forward and where we are now, and that we're still talking about them. And even if the struggles are the same and they still feel pretty contemporary, even though 100 years have passed, you know, I hope that they'd be happy, like, with what's going on. And I hope they'd feel like things are a little better.
Yeah, to me, I felt as I, you know, was reading through your book, you were like taking us on this, like, what is it, like a time machine where you're able to kind of take us back and vividly see some of the things that they were up against and then bring us back to that New York life. In Austrian, again, you write about memory and identity. How do you define home after this experience in writing this book?
To me, home is where you can feel like yourself without having to put up walls and without having to pretend to be somebody you're not. I think that over the years, and maybe this is just kind of a function of different jobs that I've had and different sort of situations that I've been in. I mean, sometimes you get into those rooms, right? And you get into those jobs and you're like, oh my gosh, like, what am I doing here? And then you don't know how to act and you don't feel like yourself in those spaces. And you learn how to, what you're supposed to say and kind of how you're supposed to do things, but you don't feel like you, and you don't feel like you can just go into a room and speak your piece and it'll be fine. You know, there's all these like things kind of bubbling under the surface that maybe you don't understand, or just, I don't, whatever, people are playing their power games and you're not a part of that. And so to me, this idea of home is just where you can go and, you know, go to the, like, a bar on the corner and just sit down and have a conversation with somebody and, you know, it's fine. You know, you're not trying to be anybody other than yourself. And that can happen in lots of different places, right? Like, it depends where you're comfortable. It depends what language or languages you speak. It depends, I mean, to a certain extent on what you look like and what other people look like around you and how open and tolerant these places are, how diverse they are. You know, one of the things that I found really interesting was just that, you know, when my family left Austria, when they left Vienna, like in the 1920s and 1930s, it was an incredibly diverse, multicultural city. And a lot of that was destroyed in World War II just because of this, you know, this Nazi obsession with, you know, having their own vision of the world. And these worlds and subworlds and everything that were just completely destroyed that really fueled creativity and hope and people, you know, same things that we still want today, people wanting to grow, people wanting to learn, people wanting to kind of be in the middle of things. It's fascinating to me. But to me, like, this idea of home and belonging that's so central is one of the things that I love to do, like, no matter where I am, is, like, if I can just go on a subway somewhere and just, like, go and, you know, get off at a stop that I've never been on to before and, you know, just get out and walk around and see what's there. And, you know, if you can do that and nobody bothers you and you're just kind of doing your thing, that's also a kind of home and that's also a kind of belonging, because you can be anywhere and you can do that in so many different places in the world. So I don't know, home's where you feel like yourself.
You know, in writing this book, there were some deep and difficult kind of things you had to uncover as well. As you were doing your research and putting these things together, it was a sequence of many pictures. And as you're putting these together, there's some sad moments, obviously. Uncovering your family's hidden Holocaust history, what did it teach you about silence and survival?
Well, that's a great question, Jules. I think silence can be a power move. I think silence is a way for people to just, you know, the truth. I mean, you know what happened. You know that it was terrible. But there are people that you can talk to about it. I mean, it's not like, you know, I'm totally certain that like my grandfather and his sisters and their mother, you know, they talked about what happened and all of their, you know, extended family and cousins and other aunts and uncles who weren't able to leave Europe. But that wasn't passed down. And I think that that was very intentional so that, you know, the generation of my mom and my aunt who were born after World War II, you know, they're in their 70s and 80s now, so they're getting on. But, you know, they didn't want them to have that level of I don't know if it's burden. I don't know if it's, I don't know what it is. Because, you know, in a way, I think, you know, being the next generation down now and not having that baggage. I mean, you feel it in other ways, but you don't feel it in the same way, I think, that people whose parents, for example, were much more directly affected, right? They were fighting, they were in the camps, they were involved, you know, and I think my family saw themselves as being very fortunate to have been in the U.S., to have been able to leave relatively early on, to have left and missed the worst of what did happen to their extended family and, well, my extended family now. But, you know, they didn't tell those stories to my mom and my aunt, and there was never any real thought or intention of even trying to go back, because there was nothing to go back to, really. Like the what they had lived and the world that they had inhabited before they came to the U.S. was completely gone. It was completely destroyed in the war, and all the people that they loved and cared about had been killed. So if you don't talk about that and you just try to let it go and you try to give your own kids and, you know, your grandkids a little bit more of a blank slate and actually, you know, succeed in a way in it, I mean, then you get people like me popping up being like, hey, what happened? But but at least to the extent that, you know, a lot of people who grow up with survivor parents, you know, they have a lot of sort of residual trauma, sort of displacement, things like that. So I think they did the best they could, to be perfectly honest, and understanding the story and understanding, you know, the silence around what happened, I think also gives me a lot more empathy for what they went through, for what they survived on their own, even if they wouldn't have considered themselves victims. I mean, if your world is destroyed, like, okay, what are you other than a survivor? I think that that's how they saw themselves.
And you did just more than that. You dug into this research. You interviewed many people who were willingly open to share their story. Although difficult at many times, you were able to record this with no biases. Very difficult to do when you understand some of these people were related to you and related to your grandfather in many ways as friends and colleagues. Were there moments when you wrote this book that you felt your grandfather's presence or his absence more stronger than others while you were putting this book together?
That's a great question. Why are you asking me all the good questions?
I really did enjoy this book, Anne, for real. And I'm not, to me, this is a debut book for you. I know there'll be many more, but I really was connected with this because you gave it a New York spin, but you gave it an opportunity for us to touch history in a way that was tangible. We didn't have to feel left out. And there was so much that you did not leave out here. And when you talked about your grandfather, you really allowed us to learn about him. And when people get this book, I'm sure that they're going to love it because of that, because you were true to this. So tell me about that. Was there moments that you felt him around you more or not in while you were putting this down?
I guess in a way I didn't really think about it like that, because it started just as a way to try to understand what was going on and to understand these, you know, what I was kind of talking about before a little bit, these pieces that nobody talked about. And I think it really started with this idea of victimhood, because the way that the Austrians framed it all was in terms of victimhood. And to me, that was like, huh, because my family never considered themselves victims and they never used that kind of language. And so it was a way to kind of think through that in a way. I think that more than anything else, thinking about, you know, when my grandfather left, you know, and started his immigration journey, like he did it as soon as he could. He left when he was 18 and he could legally apply for visas and he could legally leave the country by himself. So, you know, it was that kind of like, okay. And then you sort of fast forward from, you know, 20 when he arrived in the US till about, you know, 35, 36 when he met my grandmother and they got married. And there's this whole life in there where he was trying to figure it out. And I don't know what happened in those 15 years or so. Like, I don't know, you know, what his life was like as, you know, a 20 something in New York, just, you know, with a funny accent and trying to make it work. Living with his sister and just, you know, they lived in the Bronx and, you know, he was making cabinets and just trying to get his footing, and he got it eventually. And I think that it's this struggle also where, you know, you don't want to refer to yourself as a victim. You don't want to think about that really, you know, hard time that, you know, it's the circumstances aren't exactly the same, but now, like, say between 20 and 35, I don't think anybody knows what they want to do. I think that everybody is just trying to, you know, figure themselves out, figure out their place in the world. And to me, a lot of these lessons just like felt really relevant today, even though I'm looking at these people who were living, you know, 190 years ago, you know, like and that's crazy, right? Like, we think that things change so much, but they don't so much, especially now. Like, we are who we are as people, and we're all just kind of trying to find our place in this world that doesn't always have a clear place for us. And I think, like, understanding that a little bit better, you know, because the other piece of it is, like, for those of us who are lucky enough to have known our grandparents, like, we see them at a certain stage in their lives. We don't see them as, like, our age. And we don't think about the way that they grew up, especially if they don't tell us those stories. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if like, for him, it's, like, the idea of him or trying to, you know, make sense of this person that I never knew because he didn't necessarily like want to share that part of him as he got older. And that's within, you know, he's within his rights. Like, we all tell the stories that we need to tell, but when we have these like big gaps in terms of, you know, what were people doing, like 15, 20 years is a long time to not really know about, you know, mm-hmm. somebody's life, you know, why didn't he tell those stories? And I don't know, but you know, I can tell the story of trying to understand him better. I can tell the story of trying to understand what my family went through better, and then try to understand, you know, what to do with it and, you know, try to help people and other people understand that it's, you can find a lot of information that you never even knew existed. And then after that, you know, what you do with it is your own. It's nobody's going to tell you, you know, oh, well, you found out all this information about like your great grandmother and your grandfather, you know, go write a book. It's like, nobody's going to say that. And a lot of people, you know, maybe they'll write some notes for, you know, their aunts and uncles or something, but they don't, you know, do the crazy thing like I did and put it out there for the world.
My friend, I'm pretty sure this will not be your last book. I know we're going to drop this new one now, but there's more to come. Really great storytelling. For me, I did see the connection between you and your grandfather. And that's how I thought about this. I saw that you were trying your best in within the gaps, whether it was the 15 years that you didn't know too much about. Maybe it was his quiet approach about things, but the way he carried himself, I think you pieced this nicely. Many times for us, when we're dealing with this, in inheritance of trauma, for us, families of refugees and people who are displaced, there's a lot of issues that we get with this reconnection piece to who we are, to our beliefs, to our homeland. And when we're trying to unpack this, it does reopen some of these generational wounds. Some of the things that we are worried about, you get to see. And yes, this was a book 80, 90 years ago, and this happened, but there was a sense of connection that I think you really did well with this that really spoke to what it may have looked like, making it seem like this just happened just last week. So that was a nice way that you kind of brought this in for me. as someone who is engaged in education and in technology and all the things that you do, how do you see your personal story connecting with social change? Thinking about that, back then there was no ways to communicate with families. You rode on a boat, you got to one place to the other. You probably lived in different states for longer than you needed to just to make things clear. How do you think your experience and the work that you've done kind of touch or impact that, had that been the situation for them?
Yeah, so I think that my work made me a lot more sensitive to doing this research and understanding what I was finding, and being able to relate it to what we have today. So, and you get into a lot of the, you know, the issues that, that again, like they're still present today. So for example, in the case of, you know, the Vienna, for example, that my grandfather grew up in and left behind, like his family was working class. He went to trade school. He learned to be a cabinet maker. And that was something he could kind of take with him no matter where he went. But the thing is that like that trade itself, when he, even when he learned it, it was like a really old school kind of thing to do. And Vienna was very well known, you know, for this very, very, you know, elaborate, ornate, fancy furniture that a lot of very wealthy people had. And so, you know, kind of coming to the U.S. and you know, this is what he had to work with, and he had his tools, and he could kind of do it. But, you know, he had to adapt too. And, you know, by the time like my mom and my aunt was born, the sort of like old school skill set that he had, it was relevant, but it wasn't how he was going to make a living, and it wasn't how he was going to make money. So he, you know, ended up, like when my mom and my aunt were little, he ran a factory that was making, of all things, like television cabinets. Like nobody has a television cabinet anymore, but back then that was like state of the art, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just one example. But, you know, I think that with a lot of what I see, at least, is that you have sort of a core skill set, whatever it is, and a lot of it just involves grit, and it involves, you know, kind of poking your head up and looking around you and saying, okay, like I know how to do this thing, but this thing isn't working anymore, or this thing is like way too niche for what where I see things developing and where I see things going. And so you have to kind of be like savvy enough to kind of look around and say like, okay, what can I do with what I have when all these other things are going on? So, you know, you fast forward it to today, and, you know, I'm working a lot with, you know, AI and building courses with AI and things like that. And, you know, it's, if you don't understand what you're doing, like everything's going to sound good. Like if you don't know what kind of wood to use, you know, maybe things will look good, but the piece of furniture is going to rot in 3 years. And who wants to have to, like, you know, buy a new table every 3 years if, mm-hmm. if what you think you're buying is like for the long haul? So, you know, I think that there's a lot of things in common, you know, at least in terms of like how we move through the world and what kind of skills we need, and how we need to kind of look around and say, like, what are other people not seeing? And what do I see that's different because of who I am, because of how I grew up, because of what I'm good at, because of what I was trained in? You know, what can I do that's different? What can I do that can contribute differently? And all this stuff with, you know, AI, it's only as good as what you put in. And it for a lot of people, it's garbage in, garbage out. You know, the technology is there, but if you don't, you know, if you're not sort of judicious with how you use it, it's just a lot of noise. And that's the same with a lot of things. And it's, you know, for me at least, I think that the core of any of this is, you know, where are we coming from with our values, and what kind of good do we want to put in the world? And a lot of the rest of it is just hype, and it's just fluff. And so you have to kind of like keep centered in that good stuff if you're lucky enough to be able to exercise that, and to be able to, you know, have these jobs and have these experiences that you know, let you, you know, try to do things differently.
Mm. And what can our listeners get from your book that we've not talked about yet?
I think that everybody can do this for themselves. I mean, maybe it's not going to end up with, you know, this, you know, sort of full blown, oh, like now if I wanted to, I could go live in Vienna. I don't really want to be perfectly honest. I mean, I'm a project oriented person, and you know, reading the article and seeing that I could do something, it's like, oh, well, why not? Like, let's, you know, research and see what happens. And if I'm going to do a project, I'm going to see it through to the end. That's just the kind of person I am. But anybody can kind of dig in at any point in this process. It's amazing what's out there. It's amazing, you know, in the case of like Austria, they have incredibly good records, but you know, the Catholic Church also has really good records from countries all over the world. Immigration records to the US, they become public after 75 years. So like you can go to the library, you can go on Ancestry, you can type in, you know, your great grandfather's name, you know, and see what pops up. And it might be his immigration records. And then you're like, wait, what? Like this is crazy. So, you know, I just started out like anybody would. I'm not a genealogy expert. I'm just, you know, I know how to poke around some databases sometimes. And anybody can do that. And libraries have all of these databases available, and librarians can help. So you can get started somewhere with all that. And then just see where it goes, you know, see what you find. Also just New York City, like the records are incredible. I was able to find, you know, all these marriage records and all these census records. It's crazy. It's incredible what is out there. And then, you know, everybody has these family stories that they know. So, you know, if your family came from, you know, somewhere in Latin America, or your family came from somewhere in West Africa, or your family came from somewhere in South Asia or whatever, like everybody has these stories in their families, and they have the stories that they don't tell on purpose. And so if you're curious and you want to kind of scratch that itch and kind of see, you know, what you can find and maybe put the pieces together a little bit differently, knowing a little bit about, you know, the context of whatever it was, you know, they left behind, or you know, even just sometimes when there's a gap, it's like, well, the shortest road is usually the obvious answer, right? What is it, like Occam's razor? Is that what it's called? Yeah. It's like the most obvious thing is usually the truth. Yeah, so I'm probably paraphrasing. I've always been bad at like memorizing
quotes. Yeah, well, it's spot on. Actually, you know, for me, as you were writing this book, and what was there a difficult chapter, if you could recall writing this book, and what was that like for you?
It was the part where I was talking about the extended family in Europe and just trying to understand what happened. And, you know, knowing when to stop also, because I could have gone down, you know, a rabbit hole there of just, you know, trying to, you know, having the family tree that I found on Ancestry with like the four, you know, brothers and sisters on one side and the eight brothers and sisters on the other side, and trying to find, you know, what happened to every single one of them. And I found out what happened to one person, and I was like, I don't think I can do this. I just need to move forward, because also what happened to all of them, I know that it was awful. And I also know that, you know, if I stay in that hole, that's an awful place to be. And I need to sort of pick myself up and move on with the story. And just knowing even that like first bit of it, like definitively what happened to one person, and pretty much knowing, that everybody was killed, that was enough for what I was looking for. Maybe somebody else would have gone and like tried to find all the siblings and tried to, you know, trace all that. But to me, I just couldn't do that. But it didn't mean that I didn't want to know. It just meant that I couldn't do it. And I recognized that I couldn't do it. So, you know, that was really hard. But we all have to know our limits too, right? Like we have to know, you know, I can go to this point, and then beyond that, I don't think it's for me. So, you know, that's also part of the journey, right? Like, how far can you go? How far do you want to go? How far do you want to push it? And what do you want to do with that once you know it?
Like, I saw some of that tippy-toeing when you reference Han. That was a difficult part of this book. And there were things, yeah, that you were saying about how to even dig deeper and taking that step back. And kudos to you, to, you know, letting us know about it, but also giving us a chance to say, look, I just, you guys can piece it together, like really, really well written in that way. Did you ever question whether reclaiming this Austrian citizenship was a betrayal of your family heritage and values, or was it a form of honoring it?
I think it's, in a way, maybe it's they're two sides of the same coin, in a way. I think that, you know, I don't know that they would see it as a betrayal necessarily, but I, you know, my grandfather, after my grandparents retired and, you know, they were lucky, they had pensions and they were able to travel a little bit. And my grandmother wanted to go to Vienna because that was where my grandfather grew up, and, you know, she'd never been, and she wanted to see where he grew up. And he was like, absolutely not, like, not going back. There's nothing for me. No. And they traveled other places, and, you know, they had a very nice retirement, but they never went, and he just didn't want to. And when this came up, like, my mom and I talked about that a lot, actually, like what he would have thought. And I think that he would have thought that it's important to be as open as you possibly can be, because that was, you know, how he moved through the world, and that was the person that we knew. And in his case, you know, that door was closed. He didn't have to reopen it. But for us, it's different. You know, it's generations down. That country's changed. The people in the country have changed. You know, they're the ones who are reopening the door. And, you know, you have to, I think, be at least open to seeing if somebody's going to be genuine about this kind of, you know, reparation, in a way. Because the thing is, Austria already paid money to people whose stuff they took, whose property they took, whose, you know, paintings, all that. But it was still like, you know, you're out of here, you're gone, you know, you're done, the door is closed. And to open the door and say, no, you can come back if you want to, I mean, that's a very different kind of approach. And when I've talked to people about it, because I think at the beginning, you know, we were very skeptical if people were genuine there about, you know, like, why this, why now? You know, they're kind of obvious questions. But everybody that I've talked to, everybody's been, you know, very open. I was talking to somebody at the Austrian embassy in Washington about this stuff. And I called, you know, this whole process like an olive branch from them. And he was like, he corrected me. He was like, it's not an olive branch. Like, we were wrong. This is a real, you know, opening. It's not an olive branch. And I was like, okay, you're the one who's like, who works for the government. Like, okay, you know, you're. So, yeah, they're very genuine about it. And I think that if my grandfather had seen that, he would have appreciated it. He might not have wanted to walk back through the door, but I think he would have recognized it. And I think he would have said, okay, like, y'all manned up, like, good. Y'all finally did. So yeah, I think, and we wouldn't have known all of this stuff if they hadn't opened the door. I wouldn't have, you know, done all this digging, and we wouldn't have figured it out. So I hope that they would be happy with the book. I hope they would be happy with how they're represented. I hope that, you know, they would be happy with the story that I'm telling, because in the end, it's not even really their story. It's my version of their story, and it's my story. So I don't know what they would think, but I would hope that they would be happy.
Listen, I'm pretty confident that this is going to reach different ages. It's a well-told story of your life, obviously, but it's a great way to really connect. Like, what kind of reader do you hope Austrian Again reaches, or kind of comforts when you look at this?
I think anybody who is curious to know more but doesn't know where to start. Because it's also, you know, there are these family stories and kind of, you know, vignettes and stuff like that. But then there's also, you know, stuff about looking for documents. There's stuff about contacting, you know, different city offices. There's stuff about doing the online searches. There's stuff about, you know, all these kind of different pieces of the puzzle that I went through. Because I wanted to take the person reading it along for the ride with me. because when I was doing it, I felt very alone in a lot of ways. And some of that was because of the, you know, the time when I did it, just because it was the pandemic and you couldn't go to these offices, you couldn't go to these archives, like you had to do everything on your own because we were all isolated and nobody was vaccinated. But yeah, I hope that, you know, just people who read it are, they go along for the ride and then they take whatever stops on the ride best serve them. And they run with it and they do whatever they want to do with it.
This is going to speak to a lot of people. I mean, there's a sense of this renewal of family bonds process that kind of often sparks different conversations and brings us to have different backgrounds, but kind of have the same story to bring us closer to discovery. And we want to be able to tell now that we read books like yours, there's also this thing about this dual citizenship that there's controversy behind. Some people do it for a benefit. Some do it because there's a need. Some do it because they just have to. But I think that it provides a deeper connection to our past and some of the more contemporary moves that our communities are dealing with now. With immigration the way that it is now, embracing two cultures seems to be a supportive way to accept what may and may not happen. I can tell you, from the Latino side of how things are going for us and people are getting picked up and taken back to their countries, being able to relive who we were in a different identity, I am proud to be who I am and I do claim to be a citizen of, really speaks to a lot of that. And I think that that's where your book is going to allow people from different walks of life to kind of really sit in with this and say, look, no matter where we are proud of who we are. You did justice to that and to your family, obviously. How, if in any way, writing this memoir shift your relationship with your living relatives? Is it tighter? Is it different?
It's definitely tighter. So I didn't involve anybody in the process of writing this book. Nobody really saw it until it was pretty close to the end. And then the first person who saw it was my mom, because I had to give her veto power over any of the stories that that she didn't think should be there. You're laughing. You're laughing. My mom's pretty similar to your mom.
Mama's no best, yeah.
So, you know, she read it over and there were a few details that, like, you know, didn't add up to her, so I tweaked those a little bit, and she really liked it, and she also recognized that it was my story, and so and that was important too, because if somebody is like, no, but you're telling this wrong and whatever, it's like, well, yeah, but like, this is how. So the things that she corrected, you know, were things more from her childhood and, you know, things that I would have no idea. They were just things that I had heard over the years. But, you know, so, if, you know, if I wasn't hearing it the way she wanted me to hear it, fine, she can fix that one. But mm-hmm. But the whole experience was my experience. So, you know, she didn't really go after that very much. And then one of the things that I really appreciated after I, you know, sent it around to my cousins and my aunt, one of my cousins said that it was the first time he'd read something that he was, you know, invested in the book and in the whole thing, because it was his story too. And that's like, it's beautiful, but it's also really sad in a way, because we all deserve to be reflected in books, and we all deserve to be reflected in art, and we all deserve to see ourselves, you know, in these things that are, you know, they could have a life beyond us. That's another thing with this book that I just felt was really important to, like, get it out there in this way, just because my family's always considered themselves just regular people, you know, just like anybody else. And a lot of the time you don't hear regular people's stories, and maybe it's not going to be the most, you know, I don't know, superheroes and outer space galactic and anime and whatever, but these are regular people, and there needs to be more of that and less of these, like, just totally out there, outlandish kind of things, because you know, we are who we are, and we need to see that reflected in the art and the literature that people put out there. So I appreciated what my cousin said, but it also, you know, made me a little sad that there are so many people out there who don't. Yeah, everybody knows how to read, but, you know, why do you read? Why do you open these books, and why do you watch these movies? Like, is it to get away from yourself, or is it to become more of who you are? And so in this case, I hope it helps people become more of who they are.
Where I'm from, they say that the great ones always stay humble. Let's say if your ancestors could read this book, Austrian, again, what do you hope they would feel or understand?
I hope they would feel like they did a good job. I hope they would, you know, 100 years down the line, and people are trying to tell their stories and trying to make sense of all the things that they went through that were really hard. And they're trying to, you know, understand in a way like what forgiveness looks like, you know, 3-4 generations later. And they're trying to, you know, rebuild these connections that were completely devastated because of a terrible war. So I hope that, you know, they feel like they did a good job, that, you know, people want to explore these topics, and they want to do it in a way that speaks to everybody, not just, you know, Europeans or Jewish people or whatever, that it's something that goes beyond, you know, any one of us and can be kind of a universal thing.
You know, when you're uncovering family trauma the way you did in this book, this can be emotionally intense for anyone. How did you care for your mental health as you were writing this book?
I don't know. I don't know that I did. Yeah, because it was also the pandemic. And so in a way, I think doing it, as messed up as this sounds, doing this was a way to care for my mental health because of all the stuff that was going on during the pandemic. So it was a way to kind of get away from the uncertainty of not knowing what was going to happen, and not knowing, you know, nobody knew that, you know, there was going to be vaccines in the spring. Nobody knew that, you know, life was going to go relatively go back to normal in a few months. You know, it was just like, okay, like we still can't do anything. We still can't be around people. We still have like an hour a day that we can go to the grocery store. And so doing the deep dive in a way, because there was all this other traumatic stuff happening at the time, maybe it was a way to kind of distract myself from that. Which does sound kind of messed up. But, you know, what I could do at that time, you know, when all of it was too much, was just go out and go for walks, you know, as simple as that sounds. And I think that walking is just something that's so underrated. Like, we forget how good it is for us just to get out and walk and try to get out of your head. And if you can't be around other people, you know, you don't have a lot of other options if you need to just get out and get out of your head.
You know, we made the connection earlier to how the presence of your grandfather may have been involved in this. Now that your grandfather gets to read this book, what do you want to say to him?
Just thank you. Thank you for everything. And thank you for being a person, the type of person who makes life always feel like it's worth living.
Well said, friend. Before we let you go, my friend, the floor is yours. Tell us how we can stay connected to you as you promo this book, and what to look out for you next.
So the book itself is available on Amazon and Bookshop and on the Barnes & Noble website. So Austrian, again, easy to remember. And I'm pretty sure there's not a lot of books that are out there about Austria. So... you know, it's a pretty small country, and they speak German. So there's you know, there's not a ton of Amazon options with Austria in it. And for me, I mean, I'm on Twitter X, I'm on LinkedIn. So those are the ones that socials that I use most often. And I think on, like, that's where I'm going to kind of keep people posted about events. I've got a couple things that I'm really excited about in New York in February. So stay tuned for that. Nothing's officially out there yet, but I should be there the second half of the month. So I'm very, very happy to bring the book home and to be with people who are going to get it from the beginning.
What a great conversation. And, you know, I learned a lot about the word silence and survival. You know, most times, most things are not worth speaking of, mostly because the words that must be spoken are sometimes best meant to be heard by the quiet work of listening. Don't let anyone step into your dreams with their nightmares. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or maybe. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. And thank you so much for such a beautiful conversation. Blessings to you.
Thank you so much, Jules. It was so much fun.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.